Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Nigerian officials reach an agreement with Boko Haram. The ruling party holds a strong lead in Mozambique's elections. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has named a former White House official as an Ebola czar to coordinate U.S. efforts to fight the disease. The White House said today that Ron Klain, a former top aide to two vice presidents, will take that role. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is declaring the nation of Senegal to be Ebola-free. The WHO made the designation today after 42 days, or twice the maximum incubation period, had passed since Senegal reported its last case. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told diplomats stationed in Washington that the international community must work together to resolve the Ebola crisis.
There is no country that is exempt from being able to do something to be able to contribute to this effort and help make a difference. And everything we do depends on how we coordinate our efforts as partners and how we contribute together.
Kerry said barely a third of the $1 billion the UN says is needed to fight Ebola has been contributed. The AFP reports that Air Cote d'Ivoire will resume flights to the three West African countries hit worst by Ebola: Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The Ivory Coast airline says it will resume service to those areas on Monday. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram and the Nigerian government have reached a ceasefire agreement that calls for the release of more than 200 girls the militants kidnapped in April. The two sides announced the agreement today at talks in Saudi Arabia that involved Chad's president and high-level officials from Cameroon. This is VOA News. Mozambique's ruling party holds a strong lead in early results from Sunday's elections, but the main opposition party is rejecting the counts as fraudulent. The initial returns, covering less than a quarter of polling stations, show the Frelimo party leading rival Renamo 58-30% in the parliamentary vote. A Renamo spokesman told reporters the party does not accept the results. The AFP reports that a Nigerian judge has upheld the ban on female students wearing the Muslim headscarf in state-run schools. Judge Modpue Onyeabo of the High Court in Lagos ruled that the restrictions did not violate the civil rights of students. The Muslim Student Society of Nigeria had brought the case. The AFP News Service reports that a journalist in Uganda has been fined for accusing the government of corruption. Ronald Sesbusi of the Central Broadcasting Service is threatened with a year in jail if he doesn't pay. He was convicted on defamation charges following a 2011 report that he filed alleging a local government official stole solar panels that had been donated by the African Development Bank. Press freedom advocates are worried that the conviction will hurt the media's role as watchdog over public officials. Attacks in Egypt have killed two police officers and wounded nearly a dozen other people. The policemen were on patrol in North Sinai late Thursday when an explosion tore into their car. Egyptian media report two bombs went off during a Sufi Muslim religious festival in the city of Tanta that sent 11 people to the hospital. Olympic athlete Oscar Pistorius will learn his fate Tuesday when a South African judge will sentence him for the shooting death of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. Here's prosecutor Jerry Nell.
We've had a trial where the screams of a woman, the noise of gunfire and the violent breaking down of her door with a cricket bat has predominated the proceedings. But our submission is, m'lady, that the softly spoken words of Kim Martin, imploring the court for a sentence of imprisonment that will make the accused pay for what he has done, has trounced any other noise referred to.
The runner's attorney, Barry Rue, argued for Pistorius, a double amputee, to avoid incarceration, saying the track star had become a victim in the case and had been treated unfairly. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko held a second meeting today with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande in Milan. They're trying to solve the Ukraine crisis. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The question would be whether there are other groups outside of the Boko Haram insurgency group that also have their own agenda, and whether the Boko Haram as presently constituted has a full hold on all of these tendencies.
That's Nigerian analyst Clement Nwankwo on whether a ceasefire agreement between Nigerian government and Boko Haram will bring an end to violence. Also in the news, President Obama appointed Ebola czar, and Ebola vaccine trials continue. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Zambia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour. Militant group Boko Haram and the Nigerian government have reached a ceasefire agreement that calls for the release of more than 200 girls the militants kidnapped from the town of Chibok in April. The two sides announced the agreement today after talks in Saudi Arabia that involved Chadian President Idriss Deby and high-level officials from Cameroon. Hassan Tukur, who is a close advisor of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, says Boko Haram took the first step towards suspending hostilities. Tukur and Danladi Ahmadu, who calls himself the Secretary General of Boko Haram, have told VOA's Hausa Language Service that the girls kidnapped by the militant group are to be released Monday in Chad. Ahmadu said all the girls are alive and they are in good condition and unharmed. The sources say the girls will be handed over to Chadian President Deby for transfer to Nigerian authorities. They also say Nigerian and Boko Haram delegates will meet in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, to discuss Boko Haram's demands, such as the release of imprisoned militants. Earlier, Nigeria's Chief of Defense Staff, General Alex Badi, issued an order to all military chiefs telling them to comply with the ceasefire agreement between Nigeria and Boko Haram in all theaters of operations. The ceasefire marks a possible end of a five-year insurgency in which several thousand Nigerians have been killed. Clement Nwankwo is the executive director of the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in Abuja. My colleague, Ashanafi Abeja, asked him if the Nigerian government's participation in the talks imply an admission that its military campaign has in fact failed.
Well, clearly for a lot of Nigerians, there's been real worry that the military has not been very effective in combating the Boko Haram menace. And clearly the government hasn't shown a capacity to use military force in tackling the problem. And I would think that they would prefer, in this case, to find a negotiated settlement to this rather than take military action to bring this to a halt, which is really what they should do.
There is some concern among some people that negotiating with Boko Haram on the part of the government itself would in fact end up raising the profile of Boko Haram. Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, certainly, yes. It means that the Boko Haram has sat on the table with the Nigerian government. It has acquired its own status that puts it in a certain pedestal. But the reality is that there are lots of people in the northeast of Nigeria who have an incentive to join Boko Haram because of the failures, the corruption, and the inability of government to exercise transparency and good governance in governing Nigeria.
There are two talks going on simultaneously, one in Chad and one in Saudi Arabia. In the case of the Saudi Arabia talks, the Saudi government itself, by hosting these talks, does this indicate that the Saudi government has, in effect, recognized Boko Haram as a legitimate group?
Well, my worry is that it would appear that there is a desperation on the part of the Nigerian government to bring to closure the Chibok girl's abduction, and it would appear that they have negotiated with Boko Haram to find a venue for this. And I don't think that the Saudi government is necessarily acting in recognition of Boko Haram, but perhaps may, in consensus with the Nigerian government and Boko Haram, be just providing a venue. But we have to see the details of this.
Now, reports are that ceasefire agreement may have been reached at one of these talks. Now, should these talks result in any sort of agreement, what will this mean for Boko Haram looking to the future?
Well, the sense would be that if there are talks going on, it should be with a view to bringing this whole insurgency to an end. But I worry even whether Boko Haram has full control of the kinds of atrocities been perpetrated by insurgents in the Northeast. The question would be whether there are other groups outside of the Boko Haram insurgency group that also have their own agenda, and whether the Boko Haram as presently constituted has a full hold on all of these tendencies. I worry about that.
Clement Nwankwo is the executive director of the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in Abuja. He spoke with VOA's Ashenafi Abaje. Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says the country is protected at all times from attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, but is asking its citizens to be vigilant. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa, where the American Embassy issued a terror warning earlier this week.
Ethiopia's government says that despite the terror alert issued by the U.S. Embassy this week, the country is safe. Ambassador Taya Atzka-Selassie of Ethiopia's Foreign Affairs Ministry spoke to international diplomats in Addis Ababa Friday morning.
We would like to assure the diplomatic community in Addis that we are taking every step that Al-Shabaab will not have foothold, not only in this city, but also in this country.
The U.S. Embassy in Ethiopia's capital warned Tuesday it had credible reports that the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab may be planning an attack in the Bole area of Addis Ababa. Bole is an upscale neighborhood with many hotels, shopping malls, restaurants and bars frequently visited by both Ethiopians and foreigners. The warning, posted on the U.S. State Department website, said it had no exact targets by, but warned American citizens to avoid public places in Bole. The alert said Al-Shabaab may be targeting Addis Ababa in retaliation for Ethiopian troops taking part in AU military operations against the Islamist group in Somalia. African Union forces have been successful in breaking Al-Shabaab's grip on Somalia during the past 3 years and have liberated close to 70% of areas under the group's control. The latest success was in Barawe, the last strategic town held by Al-Shabaab. U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia, Patricia Haslech, says the embassy is not trying to undermine the Ethiopian government on security issues.
If we have access to information, we need to share it with the American public. That is law, and that is what I operate under. I can also assure you that we work extremely closely with the Ethiopian government, and they were notified ahead of time of our intentions.
Ethiopia's government is also asking its citizens to be vigilant at times against any group that wants to harm Ethiopia, as the country remains in a state of high alert. Ethiopia has not had large-scale terrorist attacks compared to other countries in the region, contributing troops to the AU military mission in Somalia. Kenya has been hardest hit with multiple attacks and kidnappings, the most recent being the 2013 terror attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall, in which 67 people were killed. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Islamist militant group Boko Haram and the Nigerian government have agreed to a ceasefire. And the American Embassy in Ethiopia issued a terror warning earlier this week on possible attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The international draft document leaked from the World Health Organization blames much of the slow response to the Ebola crisis in West Africa on the agency's Africa Regional Bureau. The Associated Press today reports the document faults a cumbersome Geneva bureaucracy and the African Regional Director, Dr. Louis Sambo, for many of the agency's failures to act swiftly. Sambo is a medical doctor from Angola who has twice been elected regional director by a WHO regional committee. A recognized international expert on the virus, Dr. Peter Piot, told the Associated Press the Africa Regional Office was not competent. Pio says he called for military intervention in the crisis 5 months ago and questions why WHO did not declare a global health emergency until 1,000 West Africans died. Pio co-discovered the virus in 1976 and directs the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. WHO reports today that more than 4,500 people have died of Ebola in West Africa. More than 9,000 have been infected. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization today declared Senegal free of the Ebola virus. No new infections have been reported. Health officials declare a country free of the virus if it goes 42 days without a new infection. Senegal has experienced only one infection and no deaths. Nigeria, which had 20 cases and 8 deaths, could be declared free of the virus if they find no new infections by next Monday. And in more news, President Barack Obama today appointed Ron Klein to serve as the U.S. Ebola czar in an effort to centralize efforts to stop the domestic spread of the virus. Klein was a trusted White House advisor in Mr. Obama's first term and is now president of Case Holdings and general counsel to an investment group called Revolution. As a former chief of staff to two Vice Presidents Joe Biden and Al Gore, Klein has good relations with both the White House and Congress. He does not, however, have extensive experience in healthcare issues. After two nurses at a Dallas hospital tested positive for the virus, the White House and the U.S. government Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came under intense congressional scrutiny. The CDC has pledged increased support for domestic hospitals. However, conditions remain dire for three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and the economic losses are mounting. Sierra Leone's finance minister, Kafala Mara, says tight air travel and border crossing bans to stem the spread of the virus are killing the economies of those countries. WHO says 15 other African countries need to do more to guarantee the virus does not spread. The agency's global health director, Dr. Gloria Nutelli, listed the countries: Ivory Coast, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Senegal, Benin, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, Gambia, Ghana, Mauritania, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Togo. Concern is growing that the global Ebola aid response has been disappointing. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today made another urgent appeal for a $1 billion trust fund since his first appeal more than a month ago. $20 million was pledged and only $100,000 received. Other UN and private aid agencies have received more than $400 million in direct aid. The U.S. has contributed about half of that amount. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization helps developing countries grow better crops and raise healthier livestock. It does so by training government field agents who work in local communities. Now, those same people are being enlisted to help stop the spread of Ebola in West Africa. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The project is being kicked off in Guinea, where the Ebola outbreak began last December. A 2-year-old child was the first infected and the first to die. The significance of that was not realized for months, and the infection rate and the death toll have continued to rise. To help stem the spread, Ebola training workshops for 90 rural development and agricultural extension agents have been held in 7 districts in Guinea. Vansa Morton is the FAO's representative in Senegal and the head of the regional hub for resilience and emergency in West Africa. He says the FAO has been committed to the fight against the deadly virus.
We know that the disease has spread in rural areas, places where there is a strong agricultural sector. And for this reason, we've been working in close collaboration with our partners, the Ministry of Agriculture, of course, Ministry of Livestock, so that we could facilitate the work of human health doctors or nurses who are trying to fight against the disease.
The training was held over the past few weeks.
We could mobilize our extension services, our agricultural worker, animal health workers, to help spread the right messages regarding Ebola. We need to train the agriculture extension staff to better understand the epidemiology of the disease, to better understand how we can stop the spread of the disease by just implementing very simple measures of control, hygiene, etc.
The training in Guinea and eventually Liberia and Sierra Leone centers on communication, information, and what's called social mobilization.
We mean that in the face of such a crisis, which is deeply rooted into cultural practices, it is very important to convey the right messages to the communities. To do that, it's not just a matter of communication, it's communication in a specific cultural context. So what we mean by social mobilization is to try to convey the right messages in terms of prevention measures adapted to the local context, adapted to the cultural practices in a specific area.
Last month in Guinea, 8 members of a team were killed when they went to a rural area to raise awareness about Ebola. The dead included health workers and journalists. The attack was blamed on fear and suspicion on the part of villagers. However, the FAO-trained workers are not strangers.
In the field, there were some negative reactions towards people who were trying just to explain how to avoid Ebola, just because the situation was not explained properly or because people didn't understand. We try to understand what are the dynamics within this community so that we can spread the right messages. These people, they are in the field on a daily basis. They work with the farmers, they work with the livestock owners every day, all year. So they've got a special relationship with these people.
The FAO-led awareness campaign in Guinea is expected to reach 9,000 households. Field agents will also distribute 36,000 bars of soap and 9,000 bottles of chlorine. They'll also work with local communities to establish Ebola early warning systems to look for signs of the disease in wildlife. The FAO says strengthening the role of Guinea's ministries of livestock and animal production in the fight against Ebola will also help ensure food security. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
An anti-Ebola virus vaccine being tested this week on 7 human volunteers at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Bethesda, Maryland, is one of 2 vaccine candidates being fast-tracked in the United States for possible use in the West African epidemic. The trials began Monday, and they have the potential to protect hundreds of thousands of West Africans against the Ebola virus that has killed more than 4,000 people and infected an estimated 8,000 in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. From Washington, William Eagle has the story.
The director of the Army Research Institute's Ebola vaccine trials, Colonel Sean Remick, said the trials will determine safe dosages of the vaccine, called VSV Ebola vaccine, among healthy volunteers.
We initiated on Monday, and we continue to recruit and to vaccinate as of today. We'll have 39 volunteers. And those volunteers will be put into 3 different groups incrementally. And those groups will be dosed at a different dose and then monitored for safety very closely. We currently have 7 vaccinees. We plan on doing probably 5 to 7 by the end of the week.
They are recruiting another 32 healthy volunteers for the lengthy human trials, Remick said. The VSV Ebola vaccine introduces a single Ebola gene, that makes the vaccine look like Ebola, but it cannot cause Ebola, Remick says. Volunteers are likely to experience only minor fever or muscle pain.
Everything that Ebola needs to be infective, it doesn't have in this vaccine. It's a single gene that codes for a single protein. So that protein is what will help the body recognize it as foreign and mount a response to it. But you cannot get Ebola from this vaccine.
If the vaccine works, it will prompt the immune system to produce antibodies that could identify and neutralize bacteria and viruses. Blood tests should indicate whether the vaccine has that effect on the healthy volunteers. Intense discussions between the World Health Organization, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and other global health agencies have centered on whether a safe vaccine could be administered to health workers in West Africa, possibly within 2 months, some say. However, Remick said the lab trials at Walter Reed will take 7 or 8 months to complete. He said he does not know whether the VSV Ebola vaccine will be introduced to health workers in the 3 African countries by December.
The decision in terms of where to move the product would be up to the sponsor, and in this case that would be NewLink Genetics. They would have to apply for, you know, a special permission to do that, and then if it was through the U.S. government, then it would be through the FDA.
NewLink Genetics of Ames, Iowa, received U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval to conduct human clinical trials last month. In addition to trials now being conducted at Walter Reed, NewLink Genetics Company President Dr. Charles Link said his pharmaceutical firm would seek trials in Europe and Africa and has signed an agreement with another company to scale up production of the virus. The vaccine is licensed to NewLink Genetics. It was initially developed by the Public Health Agency of Canada's National Microbiology Laboratory. The Canadian government offered 800 to 1,000 vials, yielding 1,500 to 2,000 doses of vaccine, to the World Health Organization in September and sent 20 vials for the Walter Reed trials. Another Ebola vaccine candidate developed by GlaxoSmithKline in the United Kingdom is also going through human trials for safety at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
I would want the people in West Africa to know that Ebola is real. Ebola kills. Early detection and prompt treatment can save lives. And I'm asking our people not to victimize or stigmatize survivors. Ebola is a challenge, but together we'll all be able to overcome it.
That was Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaking to VOA Africa on the Ebola crisis.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Islamist militant group Boko Haram and the Nigerian government have agreed to a ceasefire. The World Health Organization is expected today to declare Senegal free of the Ebola virus. And the American Embassy in Ethiopia issued a terror warning earlier this week on possible attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Coming up, music from Zambia. And in our feature segment, African patients flocking to South Africa for plastic surgery. I'm Yehiyesu Uhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiyesu.
So what is on the sports menu for this evening, Douglas?
Well, yes, we're kicking off with football. Thank you. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has approached Ghana and South Africa about hosting the 2015 Nations Cup. Last week, a scheduled host, Morocco, asked CAF to postpone the January tournament because of fears over Ebola. But South Africa's sports ministry said Friday that they are reluctant to step in as a last-minute host as they cited fears over Ebola and unplanned staging costs. CAF has stated there are no changes to the schedule of next year's tournament and it will discuss the Moroccan Health Ministry's request on November 2nd before meeting Moroccan officials the following day. Speaking in an interview with Ghanaian radio station CTFM, Ghana Youth and Sports Minister Mahama Ayariga said CAF also indicated that it was firm on the tournament dates, but they will meet the Moroccan authorities and take a decision. I asked our African football guru David Legg in Johannesburg, South Africa, what he made of all this.
The current host nation, Morocco, now I say current because they dropped a bit of a bombshell at the weekend, when they said they wanted the January to February tournament postponed because of the Ebola crisis. I just don't understand this, Douglas, because voluntarily the Moroccans have agreed to host the home matches of Guinea, one of the countries worst affected by the Ebola crisis. And now they're doing a sort of 360 U-turn and saying that we've got to postpone the finals. CAF reacted very quickly. They said that the final dates stand. In other words, starting on January the 17th, finishing on February the 8th. However, they also said they will discuss the issue in Algeria on November the 2nd. I don't see the date changing, Douglas. And if Morocco were to pull out, the $64 question, of course, is who would replace them at 3 months' notice. I can only think of a couple of countries. South Africa are an obvious choice. They've twice come in as emergency hosts. In 96, when Kenya were cash-strapped, and in 2013, due to the civil strife in Libya. And then you've got to look at the North African countries like Algeria, Tunisia, or Egypt. So I think it's between South Africa, Tunisia, Algeria, and Egypt. I cannot see any other country getting their act together in such a short space of time. Even for the countries I've just mentioned, it would be a supreme challenge. But Issa Hayatou, when he digs his feet in as a CAF president, he likes to get what he demands. And I think come hell or high water, we're going to have a January-February Cup of Nations.
Yes, that's our classy African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In another development, FIFA's ethics chairman will release his findings into the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bidding contests next month. The investigation report, however, will not be made public. FIFA has been under pressure to release prosecutor Michael Garcia's report into the bid process that led to the awarding of the 2018 World Cup to Russia and the 2022 tournament to Qatar. The report was submitted to ethics chairman Joachim Eckert. Pacekat says in an interview published Friday on FIFA's website that publishing the report would put FIFA and its ethics committee in a very difficult situation legally, and instead pledged to release a statement after assessing the documents by mid-November. In athletics, the IAAF has announced the names of the three men and three women who are still in contention to become the 2014 World Athletes of the Year. High jumper Mutaz Essa Bashim, pole vaulter Renaud Lavlenin, and Dennis Kemeto, the world marathon record holder, are the three finalists. Qatari Bashim, who is 23, took gold at the World Indoor Championships in March, while Frenchman Lavillani, who is 28, broke the pole vault world record in February and won gold at the European Championships. Kenyan Chimeto, 30, broke the world marathon record last month in Berlin. The women's shortlist comprises New Zealand's Valerie Adams, who won Glasgow Commonwealth Games gold in the short put, Ethiopian 3,000-meter runner Genzebe Dibaba, and Dutch sprinter Daphne Schippers. American sprinter Justin Gallatin has not made that list, though. The 33-year-old, who has served two doping bans, was one of 10 contenders for the International Association of Athletics Federation Award. The Council of the International Athletics Foundation will select the male and female winners during the 2014 World Athletics Gala in Monaco on Friday, November 21st, 2014.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
And now let's move to Johannesburg, South Africa, and get a report from Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma.
The hunt for a new coach for the African champions Nigeria Super Eagles takes center stage in Nigerian football. Despite guiding the Super Eagles to a 3-1 triumph against Sudan in their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers on Wednesday, the Nigeria Football Federation sacked head coach Stephen Keshi and assistant coaches Ike Soronmu and Daniel Amukachi in Abuja on Thursday. NFF appointed its technical committee head Shuaibu Amodu to lead a panel of tacticians, including local Premier League club coaches Salisu Yusuf and Mbenga Ogunbote, to guide the Super Eagles in their last two Nations Cup qualifiers against the Republic of Congo and South Africa next month. Nigeria's triumph against the Sudan follows two defeats and a draw. Victory rekindled hopes among Nigerians that Africa's champions can qualify and go and defend their crown at the Nations Cup next year. Staying in Abuja, the Nigeria Football Federation on Thursday appointed Samson Siasa and Fatai Amor as head coach and assistant coach, respectively, for the Nigeria under-23 team. Siasia guided the team to clinch a silver medal at the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing, China. In Namibia, Nigeria tackled Namibia before Zambia faced Ivory Coast in Group A action at the Telecom Namibia Mobile Africa Women's Championships at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township, Windhoek, today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, the preliminary round concludes with South Africa tackling Algeria before Cameroon and Ghana face off in Group B action. Going into the final group matches, Nigeria and Cameroon are the only teams who have qualified for the semifinals. Finally, Zimbabwe beat hosts Swaziland 2-0 in a men's friendly match played in Lobamba on Wednesday.
Voice of America!
This is Sunny Side of Sports, and Daddy Shoki telling you, Sunny Side of Sports, Sunny Side of Sports.
Voice of America!
A special race weekend will be celebrated in Athens in November. A gala featuring the 2014 AIMS Best Marathon Runner BMR Awards and other honors will take place on November 7th, 2 days before the Athens Marathon. The marathon was renamed earlier this year to emphasize its unique historical background. It's now called Athens Marathon, the Authentic. The Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, has announced that Dennis Kimeto, who broke the world marathon record in Berlin at the end of September, will be the sole candidate for the AIMS Male BMR Award. As far as the women are concerned, the contest remains open with two candidates for the AIMS Female BMR Award, Rita Jepto and Florence Kiplagat. A year ago, the inaugural gala proved to be a great success with around 600 guests present in Athens. On the second weekend of November, the stage will be again belong to the marathon running. Organizers from 60 international races and more than 200 media people have already confirmed their participation in the events. AIMS and the Hellenic Athletics Federation, the organizer of the Authentic Marathon, combined to create the inaugural gala in 2013, thus giving the sport of marathon running a fresh platform with greater international profile. Athens was the natural choice of venue, given its place in marathon history. This is where it all began in 490 BCE, with the story of the Athenian soldier messenger who is said to have run from Marathon to Athens, bearing news of victory against the invading Persians, but collapsed and died on arrival. At the first Olympics in Athens in 1896, the route that brave Athenian soldier was said to have taken was used for the marathon. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Yahias.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, feeding students' minds as well as their stomachs in Nairobi's slum district of Kibera. And next, African patients flocking to South Africa for plastic surgery. But first, some music. Here is Nalu of Zambia with For Better, For Worse.
Hey!
Nalu of Zambia with For Better, For Worse. In Kibera, a large and poor informal settlement in Nairobi, Kenya, one school is doing more than feeding students' minds. As Lenny Ruvaga reports, it's also feeding their stomachs.
32-year-old Mildred Ouma goes about her daily routine. Every morning at 6 o'clock, she wakes up her son, Augustine, and prepares him for school. The 4-year-old has a glass of milk and a bite of unleavened bread called chapati before he heads off to school. He is one of only a few students who get anything to eat before going to class. This school, called Seed School Kibera, began offering early childhood education 7 years ago to underprivileged children. Today, there are 60 students ranging from 3 to 14 years of age. Benjamin Odhiambo, who has been teaching at the school for the last 2 years, says it caters to both the minds and bodies of its students.
The children look forward to the meals because most of these children come from less privileged families. This is the only meal they can afford within a day. So we are not just feeding them physically, but we are also nourishing them intellectually.
Unemployment here is rife, and most students come to school hungry, which can lead to a lack of concentration and poor performance. So the school started a food program. At 10 a.m., the students have porridge, and at 1 p.m., they get served a hot, nutritious lunch before they leave for home 3 hours later. Mildred Ouma is among the lucky few who own a business that can provide for her family's basic needs. She makes around $10 a day from selling groundnuts and buns. But she is grateful for the meals her son gets at school.
The school is close to my business, and the fact that they give me meals is great. But Augustine may not be able to stay there when he graduates from class 3. If it happens, I will ask them to help them find a place in a similar school.
Patrick Aoki, the school's director, says the food program is financed by employing some of the parents to make beaded jewelry. Sales of the necklaces and bangles generate about $120 a month.
We have an economical challenge in the slums. So one major thing we actually do is to offer a feeding program for the children. This supports them actually to be able to grow intellectually and maybe physically to be able to concentrate in their learning.
For Augustine and his schoolmates, this education may provide a way out of poverty into a more promising future. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
From tummy tucks to the perfect derriere, patients are flocking to South Africa from across the continent in search for the perfect body. When the plastic surgeon is finished, clients recuperate away from public scrutiny. Agencies specializing in medical safaris say they have seen a surge in African customers. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Africa is being swept up in the global trend towards cosmetic surgery, with South Africa emerging as the continent's top destination for their procedures. For years, the country has attracted medical tourists from Europe and the United States, but local plastic surgeons say more clients from Africa's emerging markets are opting to go under the knife. Lorraine Melville of Surgeon and Safari has been facilitating cosmetic surgeries and recuperation breaks for nearly 16 years from her office in Johannesburg. She says that over 80% of her clients now come from sub-Saharan Africa.
When the West started having its economic downturn, it was almost a symbiotic change, and you know, the scales just tilted. And we know Africa wasn't as affected by the economic downturn. There is also a huge emerging African middle class that has come to the fore. But for us, the growing market is the sub-Saharan African market. Africa's where we're looking to the future.
Clients are ushered from the airport to a plush guest house, talked through the procedure and often operated on the next day, giving a week or two to enjoy a safari or splurge on shopping for clothes and handbags while the bruises fade and swelling subsides. Clients can spend anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000 on a cosmetic procedure, and an additional $2,000 on accommodation for 10 to 12 days. For many coming from within the continent, less is more, says Melville.
A lot of Africans have a huge need for breast reduction. And also, in terms of the African market, I would certainly say breast reductions, liposuction and tummy tucks would be their main.
Dr. Chris Nijman, National Secretary for the Association of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons of South Africa, says that a favourable exchange rate and the availability of superior and safer methods have contributed to the uptick in cosmetic procedures in South Africa.
We are seeing a massive influx of patients from sub-Saharan Africa, not to mention our own emerging upper middle-class group of patients in this country. And obviously they're becoming more socially aware. The social boundaries and stigma attached to cosmetic surgery are now far less than they were before. And in addition, they now have a disposable income.
Usually highly educated and well-travelled, Dr. Snitchman says the majority of his African clients come from Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Angola and Zambia, with an increasing number from Ghana.
There's gel into certain areas that we need to, and then it lifts everything.
The market is still dominated by women, but this is also slowly changing, says Dr. Julie Sinclair, who performs dozens of non-surgical treatments a week.
Over the last few years, a lot more male patients are coming. So in terms of gender, that's changed quite a lot. But in terms of race, perhaps, a lot of Asian, Indian, Thai, Chinese, as well as black patients are realising that they can do something about something that's bothering them. And I suppose to some extent, they're more able to do it as the economical climate changes as well.
According to the APRSSA, non-invasive procedures such as Botox injections have increased by 788% globally, with surgical procedures increasing by 128% over the past decade. Statistics on South Africa's cosmetic procedure market are sparse, says Dr. Snijman.
That's a huge concern, but it is something that we're working very, very hard on to coerce our members into giving us meaningful statistics, so that we know where we stand worldwide. And for instance, you know, what are the complications? What are the procedures that are causing, you know, the most grey hairs and potential litigation?
Gaps in regulation have allowed rogue surgeons who are not affiliated with a professional association to proliferate. South Africa's medical professionals say the cosmetic surgery boom is set to continue, but with it has to come stricter regulation. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashad Smith, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of the Central African Republic, international peacekeepers and aid workers, continue to come under attack by armed groups there, a nation roiled by almost 2 years of violence that has displaced over 1 million people and killed as many as 5,000. 100,000 migrants from neighboring nations have been forced out of the country by the violence. Since the renewed fighting October 5th, at least a dozen civilians have been killed. A Polish Catholic missionary has been kidnapped near the border with Cameroon. Six United Nations peacekeepers from that country and Burundi were wounded in an ambush over the same violent weekend. The attack follows the killing of the first UN peacekeeper in the CAR, a Pakistani national, and the wounding of others from Pakistan and Bangladesh. This violence must stop immediately. We reiterate our strong support for the efforts of transitional President Samba Panza to bring an end to violence and restore stability to her country. All leaders, including those of armed groups, must work together with the government to advance the political transition process and the national dialogue, which was agreed to in the July 23rd Brazzaville agreements. Violence and calls for a change of government must stop. All Central Africans must come together now to tackle the hard work of national reconciliation, leading to a peaceful political transition and democratic elections. We condemn those political spoilers and human rights abusers who foment and commit violence. Such individuals have no place in the political future of the CAR or in positions of trust. We call for a thorough and transparent investigation of all incidents of violence against civilians. Perpetrators must be held accountable. We stand with the people and leaders of the CAR as they seek to end the violence and bring peace, stability, and security to their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately, because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.